Sometimes I wait for the John Cage Symphony to be over before I start my talk. Sometimes it goes on a little bit longer, a little bit longer. But often there's this moment where it settles. How many of you thought you had the talk schedule figured out? You come in here expecting to hear Gregorio, as I call him. It's not the kind of universe you took birth in. Not a very predictable one. Unreliable. You think you have everything figured out, and then it changes. If you had any Vedana, whether pleasant or unpleasant, related to the change, I hope you worked with it. There's a paragraph I like to read from a book by Tenzin Palmo, a Western Tibetan nun, Buddhist nun. She says, many years ago, His Holiness the Dalai Lama came to the remote Lahua Valley in India where I was living. He was there for about 1 week, giving Dharma talks and empowerments. After one of his talks, which had lasted for several hours, I turned to one of the Lahuli women and asked, do you know what he was talking about? She said, I didn't catch much, but I understood that if we have a good heart, that's excellent. There's a Cheyenne saying, our first teacher is our own heart. So what we're doing here is we're uncovering our good heart. It's there within all of us, but sometimes there are some obstacles. And we're working with those obstacles to uncover the good heart. And our own heart is our teacher in that process. Whatever is happening within our heart is what we work with, is what we learn from. It's our practice. So this afternoon you were doing compassion practice. One of the ways that we uncover our good heart is working with meeting suffering with compassion and working with our conditioned responses, our deeply conditioned responses to suffering that block that natural capacity of the heart to care, to connect, to perhaps feel tenderness, poignancy, sweetness, in connection with suffering, care. So what I want to explore in this talk tonight is explore compassion in more detail or in more depth. I think that, or I know that before I assumed that I understood what compassion was, it's like, oh yeah, compassion, you care about suffering. But a number of years ago, I really undertook to explore it in more depth to see what I could really learn. And what I found is that this quality has more depth and more breadth than I had originally assumed, I think than we often assume. And also that sometimes we get enchanted by the wisdom teachings of Buddhism, and we forget that there's two wings. There's the wing of wisdom, and there's the wing of compassion or love, the four flavors of love, and that we need both in our practice for balance. We need both to go deep. We need the wisdom teachings for the deep understanding of letting go, of what that means. And we need the compassion or love teachings for the tenderness and the softness and connectedness of the heart. So as we meditate here, we open to life in all of its reality. We discover the beauty and the joy and the enchantment, the sukha, the piti, and we also discover the dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, and despair. And we also touch our personal stories of suffering, our societal stories of suffering, and the existential suffering of being a human in this world of change, this world that is unpredictable, that delivers Rebecca when you're expecting Gregorio. To be able to stay in touch with the enormity of suffering that is present in this world, it takes a heart that is strong, supple, flexible, strong. It takes a strong heart. And we usually find our strength of the heart in the protecting of it. We often find the strength of the heart in the kind the hardening of the heart. The hardening when we meet suffering, the hardening of aversion or ill will or pushing away, anxiety, fear, all of these protect the heart. And yet we find that that very protection is unsatisfying. It's its own dukkha. And so we explore, and you've all been exploring it whether you know it or not. Your hearts are more tender than when you came in here. You might not realize it because you lose perspective. But we're really tenderizing our hearts here. And we're learning a different kind of, you could say, protection, the protection of love, of metta, of compassion, of equanimity, of the capacity of the heart to touch suffering. And stay open, not go into the hardness. There's this teacher, I think I mentioned this in the Metta sitting, Anand Thubten, and his Dharma talk that's all about melting the ice mountains in the heart. He has this Dharma talk, it's all he talks about in the whole Dharma talk is melting the ice mountains. No, he also talks about whenever he goes to New York City, he likes to take the subway. So you can watch people. He makes whoever his host is take him on the subway because he loves the humanity of it, all the humans. And his heart able to connect with all of them. And so this melting of the ice mountains, that's what this practice of love is. And what we discover is the heart that has its strength in softness, has its strength in flexibility. And we start to see that actually the soft, flexible heart is stronger than the hard heart. What's hard can be shattered. What's soft can accommodate and respond. So these qualities of metta and compassion, mudita, equanimity, you could say they're about also about making the world a safe place to go deep in our practice. We need protection to go deep in practice. It's a wild world. There are many challenges when we are connecting with reality. These qualities make the world a safe place for relaxing. A safe place to explore, a safe place to land, a safe home. I heard that one time Einstein was asked, if you could have the answer to one question, what would your question be? And he said the question was, is the universe friendly? I don't think there's an objective answer to that. I think it's subjective. The universe is as friendly as our heart is. And so through these practices, our hearts become friendly, and then the world feels friendly. Mark Nepo, a modern mystic, you could say, says that with compassion, our hearts become a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. a soft and sturdy home in which reality can land. And so tonight, talking about compassion, the second of the Brahmaviharas, the flavor of love when it meets suffering, difficulty. I want to talk about compassion similarly to how I talked about metta as embodied compassion. What does it mean to learn how compassion feels in the heart and the mind and the body? Teaching our being, you could say again, down to the level of the cells, cellular level, what it feels like to soak in compassion, to marinate in compassion. So not an intellectual understanding, but an embodied experience of compassion. So the talk will emphasize four different aspects of compassion. And what I call them is the four faces of compassion. And the four of them are Mary, Tara, Kuan Yin, and Tinkerbell. And so these four kind of archetypes, you could say they're archetypes or symbols. They give us a way to connect with facets of compassion. Connect with them and then develop them within ourselves and strengthen them. I want to make a disclaimer right at the very beginning here that my understanding of these four archetypes is very subjective. It's might not correspond to traditional views of these four aspects. It might not correspond to your view of these four archetypes. I recently got some feedback that certain aspects of Tinkerbell that I wasn't familiar with. In fact, I've gotten a lot of feedback about Tinkerbell. So that's my disclaimer, and I will explain what each of these faces means to me. And it doesn't matter exactly which symbols you use, it's really how they resonate within you. And the last thing I want to say before I go into the four is that it's okay not to know what compassion is. And it's okay when we're exploring compassion that the near neighbors, which Greg may have mentioned, the near neighbors come up in our exploration. Despair, overwhelm, aversion. The first time I did compassion practice, I was doing the four Brahmaviharas over a two-month period, and so I did mostly metta, and then I switched to compassion, and I found it quite difficult to do. I had chosen a friend of mine to work with, a friend who was very depressed, and I just kept falling into such grief because I really didn't want her to be suffering. And I remember going into my teacher and saying, "I'm getting an F in compassion." Now, you guys know there's something totally wrong with that sentence, judging our practice. But I really struggled. And then what I did is I shifted to somebody who was easier. And then I started to get the flavor. So I shifted to a woman at work whose husband was dying of cancer. And I liked this woman, but I wasn't super, super close to her. And so it gave just kind of the right person to start exploring with. I didn't fall as much into the near misses. So there's a little hint for your compassion practice. So let's look at these four aspects. The first one, I'm using the archetype of Mary. So you could say the archetype of the mother energy. And this aspect of compassion to me is the warmth. The warmth of compassion, that caring that comes out as a sense of warmth and unconditional love. So a kind of softness and deep kindness. I have a statue of Mary in my forest garden near my house, and she has her arms open like this, kind of that gesture of universal acceptance. I think of that as kind of part of the warmth of this archetype. And if mother doesn't work for you, there's grandmother, grandmother warmth. Dawn, this last, Dawn said I could tell you this story that last summer in our teacher training, she gave a little mini Dharma talk on metta, and she was describing her grandmother and how when she was a small child, her grandmother would hold her in her arms and just kind of like pour this love into her. And that the picture of that, of this grandmother holding her grandchild, grandmother who undoubtedly suffered a lot in her life and knew that her child or grandchild would also suffer, and just giving her everything she could from her heart. If a human mother doesn't work so well for you, some of you, that image might not. perhaps we can think of an animal taking care of their babies. The Buddha used the image of a mother cow with her calf. And if for some people, maybe the feminine image might not work well. I was teaching a one-day retreat on this at one point, and one of the men came up to me, and he said, you know, the mother image or the female it doesn't really work for me. I had some difficult times in my youth or when I was a child, he says, but what I came up with, he said, was Mr. Rogers. That worked for me, the image of Mr. Rogers. Now, for those of you who are from Europe, Mr. Rogers was a well-known child. What was he? He was Mr. Rogers. He was an actor on children's shows, or not an actor, it was more like a reality child show. And he was so warm. Children loved him, just loved him for his warmth. Or another image is the Dalai Lama's eyes. Sometimes you see pictures of him and there's such warmth in those eyes. And so one way I've practiced with compassion is to have the archetype of Mary, so like the images that we're doing, the archetype of Mary, and receiving that compassion practice, receiving it. And it's like, what does it feel like throughout my being to receive that care, that warmth? Sometimes I imagine it like warm honey pouring over the body into the cells. So we practice, can we let that quality in? And what's an interesting exploration is where we can't. We hit the places within where we can't. We hit the hard edges. So sometimes when the compassion hits the hardness within, we can care right there, right where the hardness is. And we can respect the hardness. We all at times feel the hardness of the heart or the bracing of the heart, the bracing of the body against reality. And sometimes when we feel that, we're like, I want it to go away. How can I get rid of this? But I recommend that we actually respect it and care about it. It's been our protection. It's been our safety. And when we try to obliterate it, it doesn't like it very much. The heart doesn't like to be bossed around. We have to approach it with such respect. And so sometimes letting in this warmth of compassion, we might hit places where we feel like we can't forgive ourselves. That's part of the hardness, or the place where the honey doesn't go into the cells. It's the places where we may feel like we're unworthy, or that we've done something unforgivable. Sometimes I think of this warmth with the word mercy. It's kind of like forgiveness. It's not a very used word in Buddhism. It's kind of like forgiveness, but I think it's even more unconditional. Mercy is like unconditional forgiveness. So we see, is there some place that we can relax into unconditional forgiveness for being human? Lynn Jensen, a Zen teacher in Oregon, says, "I'm a partner now in the brotherhood and sisterhood of inevitable error and recovery. Our human lives are 10,000 beautiful mistakes." That has that feeling of mercy, of forgiveness. I'd like to read a story that is related to this theme. There's a great book on compassion called Tattoos on the Heart. Some of you have probably heard of it, by the Catholic priest Gregory Boyle. And he lives and works in L.A. He has started it's grown into this huge industry called Homeboy Industries for gang members, ex-gang members. I know when I first talk about him in a talk, I'm a little bit, it's like worried that there's the image of the white guy going in and saving the people of color, right? But I hear from one of my teachers, Joanna Harper, who worked in Homeboy Industries. She said, he's the real deal. And there is a sense when you read the books that he has more than one book now, that he really throws his lot with the people, that he's not separate, that he becomes part of the community. So here's a story from Tattoos on the Heart. So he had gone to give a mass in Bolivia. He was invited down to Bolivia, and he'd given a mass way up in the mountains with the Quechua Indians. And then at some point, his friends had gone down ahead, and he was left up to walk down by himself, and he felt like he'd just massacred the mass, that it was very bad. He felt very bad about himself, like he'd really made quite a mess of it. He says, "I'm alone at the top of this mountain, stuck, not only without a ride, but in stultifying humiliation. I am convinced that a worst priest has never visited this place or walked this earth. With my backpack snug on my shoulder and spirit deflated, I begin to make the long walk down the mountain and back to town. But before I leave the makeshift soccer field that had been our cathedral, an old Quechua campesino, seemingly out of nowhere, makes his way to me. He appears ancient, but I suspect his body has been weathered by work and the burden of an Indian's life. As he nears me, I see he is wearing tethered wool pants with a white button shirt greatly frayed at the collar. He has a rope for a belt. His suit coat is coarse and worn. He is wearing urachis, and his feet are caked with Bolivian mud. Any place that a human face can have wrinkles and creases, he has them. He is at least a foot shorter than I am, and he stands right in front of me and says, 'Tatai.' This is Quechua for padrecito, a word packed with cariño, affection, and a charming intimacy. He looks up at me with penetrating, weary eyes and says, 'Tatai, gracias por haber venido.' Thanks for coming. I think of something to say, but nothing comes to me. which is just as well because before I can speak, the old campesino reaches into the pockets of his suit coat and retrieves two fistfuls of multicolored rose petals. He's on the tip of his toes and he gestures that I might assist with the inclination of my head. And so he drops the petals over my head and I'm without words. He digs into his pockets again and manages two more fistfuls of petals. He does this again, and the store of red, pink, and yellow rose petals seems infinite. I just stand there and let him do this, staring at my own urachis, now moistened with my tears, covered with rose petals. Finally, he takes his leave, and I'm left there, alone, with only the bright aroma of roses. For all the many times I would return to Tirani and see the same villagers over and over, I never saw this old campesino again. So perhaps this is another way to image receiving this warmth is the rose petals falling on us. So we have the compassion practice, the Brahma-Vihara practice, but we also have another way of learning compassion, which is engaging with our own suffering that comes up in our meditation practice. So our own places of pain, physical, emotional. How do we relate to those? Do we relate to them with hardness, or is there some way that we can bring in this quality of warmth? You could say infuse the mindfulness with this quality of warmth or softness. I know that I've mentioned before cotton balls, that one way that I can sometimes bring in this quality, if it's not coming naturally, is to think of touching the pain with cotton balls. Or holding the pain with that sense of how a mother might hold a child that's hurt. Experimenting to melt the resistance to suffering, our usual resistance to it, with this quality of warmth. And then as we learn this quality within ourselves, it's a quality we can extend to all beings, to all things, knowing that we all share this existential suffering of living in this universe of change, of unpredictability, unreliability, this universe with the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. So you could say that our own suffering is a proving ground where we cultivate. No, we don't cultivate. We discover the capacity of our heart to care in the face of suffering. And then we share that in the world. So let's balance this sense of warmth or vulnerability, softness of heart with looking at the power of compassion. So I think that sometimes we might have this unconscious belief that compassion is just a little bit wimpy. But it's not. It's actually a very powerful and empowered quality of heart and mind. And I sometimes, for me, represent that as the image of Tara. So Tara is a Tibetan bodhisattva, or Tibetan, I don't know, goddess, Tibetan archetype. And I can imagine her as kind of streaming out compassion from the heart, kind of this shining it out in a steady stream with so much power, that it spreads wide and that it's stronger than any obstacle that will come our way. So we start to understand compassion as this powerful and empowered state of mind that can meet any suffering and not be crushed by it. So we can feel this energetically for ourselves. Where do we find that quality in our own heart? It's really related and close to the courage that Jill talked about a number of days ago. I will not be crushed by this. So it counteracts the tendency that we can sometimes have in the face of suffering to collapse into pity or despair or aversion or overwhelm. It counteracts what's sometimes called empathetic distress, the over-identification with suffering, or cynicism, another form of collapse. When I was writing this talk, I was thinking about this kind of powerful image, and I flashed back to this image that went around the internet a while ago. Some of you might be aware of it. It was from a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Baton Rouge. It's been probably a year now. And there was this picture of this young African-American woman. She had on this long flowing skirt. And in front of her were four or five riot police with their shields, right? And she was standing there with this incredible dignity, which is also really close to this power that I'm talking about. She was standing there with, you could just feel how rooted she was in dignity and in courage and in, I think, a deep compassion. And these riot police, they were around her in like a circle, and you could see like the power of her energy. They couldn't get in it. They couldn't get any closer. You can see like where that kind of power went to, because they're all like this. All the riot police are like this kind of, because she's so strong. We can find that within ourselves. So when compassion is connected to the power of our hearts, we can feel this strength, and we can feel our own resiliency. We may have to call forth even a fierceness of heart sometimes. But usually, I think we're stronger than we assume. So on retreat, we get so much practice here, right? Practice. I mean, if you're still here, you've called up that energy a number of times, probably many times. Name it or notice it. Really appreciate your own capacity for that dignity, courage, fierceness, whatever you want to call it. It's a beautiful quality. One thing that retreat shows us, it shows us how strong we are. Because we all go through a lot of things just in one sitting, one day, and then you take 6 weeks or 3 months. So different images, if tar works for you, great, but another image might be a redwood tree. One person, when I was teaching this, came up to me and he said, my image for the power of compassion is putting on a fuchsia blazer. I love it, yeah. We're gonna, lots of energy there. It's related, right, to calling forth the energy to meet our suffering. So through this process, right, our hearts become stronger, capable of holding more. That's really what happens on retreat, is you could say our hearts become stronger and then they become larger and they become more open. They can hold more. I just started to read a book called Sadness, Love, and Openness by some Tibetan teacher. I can't remember his name right now. And he says they're all the same. Sadness, love, and openness. The sadness connecting with suffering. The love and the open heart. As we trust the strength that we have, then we trust our hearts to be open. So rather than trying to melt those ice mountains with boiling water or something, melt them quickly and fast, we actually can connect with our strength. And when we connect with our strength, the melting happens. It's safe. So, if we can meet suffering in this way, recognizing the power of compassion, then it's easier to manifest what I'm calling the third face of compassion, represented by the archetype of Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin, also a Tibetan archetype or bodhisattva, though Brian told me recently, a few days ago, that there's some scholarly research that suggests that this bodhisattva image was present in early Buddhism, but got kind of moved out of some of the texts. So who knows? I'm going to claim her a little bit for us here. And so Kuan Yin is recognizable. There's different images of her. We have some here, but there's also images of her sometimes with many different arms and hands to be able to serve. And also she's often, like out in the walking room, she's represented with one knee up. So she's sitting, but she has one knee up. And it's said that she's seated that way because she wants to be ready to jump up and alleviate suffering where it may be. She wants to be able to jump up and act and alleviate suffering. So for me, she represents the action part of compassion. So part of the power of compassion is this wish and action to alleviate suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh says compassion is a verb. So we don't just connect with compassion, like with the practice, the Brahmavihara practice, for example. We do connect with the suffering, our own or others, but the compassion part is the wish to alleviate suffering. So we connect with the suffering for the resonance, right? For the to be touched by it. But then the compassion is the sweet wish to alleviate suffering and to respond when we can. So it's a call to respond. And again, this counteracts the tendency to crumble in the face or to collapse in the face of suffering. So we'll talk more towards the end of the retreat about responding in the outer world, but for now we're going to keep the conversation in the meditation hall, in the meditation center. And so the question might be, how do we respond compassionately to our own pain? What is the response? Sometimes a good question is, what is needed now? What is needed now? We might push against it. Is that what's needed now? Sometimes determination might be what's needed, but sometimes softness might be what's needed. There was one book where a Zen teacher was asked if Kuan Yin is real. And he answered, to see her, all you have to do is perform a selfless deed. I'll read another story from Tattoos on the Heart. Clever, the name of the young man. Clever seems eager to begin at Homeboy Silkscreen, and at 22 years old, he has assured me he is ready to retire his jersey from the barrio. He moves with me easily through the factory, shaking hands cheerfully with those printing shirts or catching them as they spit through the conveyor belt dryer. Even enemies he greets and looks them in the eye. One of the rules of homeboy industry is you have to get along with your enemies. No warfare. Until he turns a corner and sees travieso, which means mischievous in Spanish. Until he turns a corner and sees travieso, a 24-year-old from an enemy hood. In unison, they stare instantly at their feet. Some mumbling takes place, and there's a great deal of mutual shifting of body weight. They do not shake hands. I think, hell, he's just finished shaking hands with all sorts of enemies. I discover sometime later that the hatred they hold for each other is profundo. Not only is this a neighborhood pedo, this is also personal. Some delito has transpired between them, and the breach is beyond repair. I can sense this much in the moment, even before the details get filled in later. Their eyes still epoxied to their Nike Cortezes. Look, I tell them, if you can't hang working together, please let me know. I got a grip of homies who would love to have this holly. They say nothing, so that's that. Some 6 months later, Travieso finds himself surrounded in an alley, greatly outnumbered by members of an enemy gang, who beat him badly. Well, he is lying. I'm not going to read that sentence. Too intense. Anyway, he winds up in the hospital on life support. The doctors wait for 48 hours to secure a flat read, and then they can officially declare him deceased. This allows time for relatives to journey to Los Angeles. I am speaking at St. Louis University and fly home. I have seen a great deal of horrifying things in my lifetime. Nothing, however, compares to the sight of this kid, a wonderfully gentle-souled kid with his head swollen many times to its size. It's breathtaking. I can barely keep my eyes trained on him as I smear sacred oil on his forehead and we say goodbye in the pull of a plug. In those first 24 hours after his death, I'm in my office late at night and the phone rings. It's Clever. Hey, he begins awkwardly, that's messed up about what happened to Travieso. Yeah, it is, I say to him, brought back to the hollow area of my soul which this sadness has carved. Is there anything I can do? Clever asks, with oddly high energy. Can I give him my blood? This last offer sucks the breathable air out of the atmosphere for both of us. We can each feel the other tremble in silence. Clever takes the lead and punctuates the quiet with great resolve and unprotected tears. He was not my enemy. He was my friend. We worked together. Kuan Yin. So last but not least, Tinkerbell. So I'm not sure what Disney has done to Tinkerbell. I haven't seen that. Originally, I was thinking of Tinkerbell from the movies that I watched when I was a child in the 60s. but I also hear that I had some selective memory of her. I've been informed of that. turns out she's quite controversial. but maybe we could call her the fairy archetype. So some of you are probably wondering what Tinkerbell has to do with compassion. I even had doubts about mentioning her. You know, like, what about my reputation, my credibility here? But I was talking to one of the trainees, and she's like, oh, Rebecca, Tinkerbell has to stay. I'm like, all right, okay. So I didn't go looking for Tinkerbell. She came to me. I was doing this practice that Soltram Alione teaches called feeding your demons. And what you do is you imagine in front of you a very wounded part of you, and you feed this part nectar. You just give it all this love and nectar. And then at the end, you ask for an ally to help you working with this this wounded part. And so I asked for an ally, and Tinkerbell shows up. And I'm like, can I have somebody else? You can't be serious. I'm trying to do some serious spiritual practice here. But Tinkerbell's who I got. And over time, I've really come to see the power of this archetype. Tinkerbell is spunky, or my Tinkerbell is spunky. And you need a lot of spunk to be really compassionate. I recently read a book about the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. It's a book about joy, and it's about a week the two spent together to celebrate the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. Apparently they're good friends. And they're also two great archetypes of compassion, right? And what's amazing is both of them have seen so much suffering, you know, that we can't even imagine, both the Dalai Lama in Tibet and Desmond Tutu in South Africa. And reading the book, you can just feel the spunk coming out of both of them. I just realized spunk is probably not a word. Maybe people, English is their second language, might not be a well-known word. What's another word for spunk? Any of you guys know another word for spunk? Determination. It's more than determination, though, right? It's grit. But it's lighter than that, right? It's light. Yeah. Sassy, yes, okay, sassiness. That's not a totally used Latin word, too, but spunk, sassy. But they're both like that. And you know it has something to do with their great big hearts. You know it's related, right? It says that Desmond Tutu loves to dance. He likes to boogie to really get down. So there's this spunk. Oh, and Dalai Lama's eyes, right? Sometimes they're warm, but sometimes they have this little sparkle in them. That's it. That's Tinkerbell. So it's this energy that reminds us to not take ourselves too seriously, or not to take things too seriously. So there's a way, it's a lightening quality. So it's this idea, perhaps, of bringing in the bigger picture. Or it's also the bringing in this wide open space of possibility, of don't know. You could say the wisdom of emptiness. We don't know what's going to happen. Tinkerbell reminds us of that. Now, we can get so caught when we're suffering, we can get so caught in such a narrow view. And we can be so sure how things are going to turn out, usually disastrous. And you know, there's that, Tinkerbell's like, lighten up, open up the mind, open up the heart. We don't know. Can we hold that? There's a sense of mystery and magic with that. We could, if you want a different word, call this the equanimity part of compassion. Letting go of attachment to results, to things being a certain way. So this balance is absolutely essential for us not to get bogged down or overwhelmed by the suffering. And it's a lightness and spaciousness that by itself would be a frivolous or superficial or ungrounded response to suffering. But when it's combined with the other three faces of compassion, it's a balancer, a strengthener. So perhaps when you get caught in yogi mind, I think you've probably heard about yogi mind, that some little thing happens on retreat and then it gets huge, right? Somebody walks by you in a certain way and then we're like, oh my God, they don't like me. And then you're sure they don't like you, right? And a whole big story. Maybe we can call in Tinkerbell. It's like, lighten up, lighten up. This is a quote that I've been dying to read. It does fit. This is from Alice in Wonderland. Seems related to Tinkerbell. There was a time when Alice in Wonderland, she protested to the Red Queen, "One can't believe impossible things." The Red Queen told her simply she hadn't had enough practice. "Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." That seems like Tinkerbell to me. And the last part about Tinkerbell is what we start to understand and see is that opening to pain, opening to suffering, is also opening to joy. That life is a package deal. And as we find that our hearts grow in the capacity to connect with suffering, with mindfulness, with wisdom, with compassion, what we also find is that our hearts grow in the capacity to feel joy, to connect with joy. So we start to trust the whole process of connecting with suffering. We start to trust this process of the opening of the heart. Perhaps the last trick of Tinkerbell. Somebody else suggested that another archetype related to Tinkerbell might be comedians. That comedians have that, are jesters. Have that quality of opening it up. And so we have these 4 archetypes or 4 symbols that point to 4 qualities of compassion that taken together and absorbed into the body help us to understand how we can relate to suffering in a way that's onward leading. So sometimes we might need the warmth of the archetype of Mary to soften our hearts, or the mother archetype for those of you who, I know some, I've also heard of some people with childhood issues with Mary too. So so sometimes we might need the warmth of that mother archetype to soften our hearts and learning how to absorb that energy into ourselves so it becomes a default of not only our heart, but the default of ourselves. Or sometimes we might need the power of Tara to remind us of the strength of compassion. The power, the empowered quality of that compassionate heart. Or sometimes we might need the quality or archetype of Kuan Yin to remind us to respond, that we can respond, we can help, so that we don't get caught in apathy or cynicism. And sometimes we might need to call on Tinkerbell to touch us with the sense of magic and lightness and spunk. And as we develop the capacity to meet suffering with compassion, our hearts become a soft and sturdy home where real things can land. Our hearts become warm and powerful and responsive and light. A little Dalai Lama story. One more. The day before, I had interviewed His Holiness for Elle magazine. At the end of our hour together spent in his small, bare hotel room, I stood up, plucked up my courage, and asked, "What is the meaning of life?" His Holiness flung his head back and roared with laughter. Then he grew intensely concentrated and still. "The meaning of life," he said quietly, leaning forward to touch my forehead with his, "is to embody compassion. Anybody can discover this. When you discover this and live it, you discover your truest nature and share its joy." Let's sit for a minute.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.